John, tag, you're supposed to run after me after I touch you. You can't. That's not how tag works, the way you're playing.
It's a regional thing. I'm playing Midwestern rules.
Oh, I should have known that. Okay, yeah. My bad. Yeah. Sorry.
Hey, speaking of, Dave, you know, with Memorial Day coming up,
I'm guessing you're
probably getting ready for plenty of fun days in the sun.
Oh, my gosh.
Am I right?
First, I have to learn these rules for tag. But, yes, everyone knows this, John. Everyone knows that time in the sun is best enjoyed with a pair of shades that you don't have to baby.
Oh, yeah.
Knockaround is the original affordable sunglasses company, and they've got just what you need for Memorial Day weekend, MDW, for those of us who celebrate all year, and all the way through summertime.
They do. And with over 20 different frame styles, there's something for the whole family, including tons for kids.
So, whether you're looking to rock a pair of red, white, and blue shades for the big weekend, or just to restock your collection before summer gets here, Knockaround has you covered.
Now, Dave.
Yeah.
Did you know that all their lenses have UV 400 protection, which is basically like sunscreen for your eyeballs?
Oh, man. And I've put copper tone just right on the old ojos, and it burns. It is burning still to this day.
Yeah, well, you keep putting it on.
Well, it's a habit. With polarized adult pairs starting at $28, you can get a few pairs to leave in your car, toss in your beach bag, or lend to a friend in need.
You know, Dave, where I come from, Memorial Day weekend means it's race day.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and
oh,
there's no more important place to have some shades than outside at the track.
Oh, yeah.
If you've heard me say that once, you've heard me say that a million
it's
times.
It's on your front yard.
I think I might actually just buy a pair of Knockarounds in that color.
Yeah.
Like in the color of each car, actually.
Yeah.
And it's switching back and forth based on who's leading the race.
Love that. That's one of the best ideas you've ever had.
So listen, Dadville fans, take that idea and run with it. Also, don't be the one squinting through family beach days or trips to the park. Go to knockaround.com and use the promo code DADVILLE15 for 15% off your order.
That's DADVILLE15 for 15% off your order at knockaround.com.
I just said that.
Hi, I'm Dave Barnes.
And I'm John McLaughlin.
And welcome to Dadville.
Dadville is a podcast where we talk about life, love, and the pursuit of awesome dadding.
It's funny thoughts and deep talks.
So please, enjoy your time here in Dadville and enjoy this episode with...
James K. A. Smith.
Oh man. Hey, man. Dave.
Yeah.
I want to talk about one of my favorite podcasts.
Okay.
Will you leave space for me to do that?
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate it. It's a show that both you and Annie and Amy and I have had the pleasure of being on as guests.
Aww.
Now, who's to say which episode was better? Let's not get bogged down in the numbers. It's Raising Boys and Girls with Sissy Goff, David Thomas, and Melissa Trevathan, three counselors who are serving kids and their parents here in good old Nashville, Tennessee.
You said it, John. Ours was the more popular. You said it, John. We did have fun on that podcast. I love Sissy, David, and Melissa, and it was great to be on their show. We were actually on their live podcast, episode 155, if you want to take a little gander, okay? Is it the best one? I don't know. Is that what they've told us? Yes. What was your episode, John? Do you remember?
Well, Dave, look, I'll go ahead and be vulnerable with you right now and tell you that it was episode 119, Parenting with Vulnerability, and both David and Sissy fainted in the middle of it because it was so good. Don't fact check that.
Well, you can see right there that you're pretty awesome at being vulnerable, John, and that's me being sarcastic.
Thank you, Dave. You know, in each episode of Raising Boys and Girls, they share some of what they've learned in the work that they do with kids and families on a daily basis. Their goal being to help parents care for their kids in their life with a little more understanding, a little more practical help, and a whole lot of hope.
That's right, John. Episodes are released every Tuesday, and in addition to checking out episodes 119 and 155, especially 155, I would also recommend episode 73, Raising Emotionally Strong and Worry-Free Kids, or episode 75, How to Help Kids Navigate Emotions.
More information can be found at raisingboysandgirls.com/podcast. Check it out today.
Okay. Do I sound okay to you?
Mm-hmm. Sound great.
Okay. I can hear you guys.
I would say you've never sounded better to us, honestly.
not much of a comparison, right?
Yeah. We are thrilled you're on, by
yeah,
the way.
Yeah, welcome
Thank
to Dadville.
So much chat. For doing this. So much for doing this.
My pleasure.
So many plethora of books behind you, by
You know
way.
What I'm Just noticing so. Is, because we've had several guests on that are very learned, as yourself, and they come on and they have books in the background, but I don't think anyone has had so many books that there are books piled on top of the books that are upright. They're like horizontal
oh,
in there.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's a lot of books.
It just keeps going.
Ends. Oh, my Look gosh. At this. Oh, my gosh. The panoramic. It just never
is. So I don't
is it legal
have,
to have that many books in one room?
Oh, my gosh.
That's all
you're
the window
peddler.
I get, though. So it's good that my window is small because it means I have...
You know what it would mean? It would yeah. mean you may have a small window, but you have many windows to the world. And I think we yes. should end there, actually. I'm not going to
well
beat that.
Done.
I'm
going
that should be the way we go out.
Mic drop. Yes, right there.
Oh, my gosh. So, guys, we have James K.A. Smith. What do you go by?
Please call me Jamie. What? Yes.
Jamie. Okay, good. Okay, Jamie. So we have Jamie with us today. I'm thrilled about this, by the way, and I'm so excited you made time for us because I love love what you do, and so this is a real honor to
Thank
have you.
You.
So we start with what we call the brag sheet. So this is, you know, just getting to know you. Here's the things that you've done. Well, you know, there's more than you've done, but here's like
yeah,
a,
yeah.
you know, like a smattering, a flyover. Okay, here we go. Earn Master of Philosophy in Philosophical Theory from Institute of Christian Studies, which all you put any of those words together in any format, and I'm already overwhelmed.
Philosophical theory.
That is Woo. Just so intense. Okay, Doctor of Philosophy from Villanova University, has taught at Loyola. Go, come on now. Roar? I guess I don't know what the right
What a wild word.
Yeah. Yeah.
Has taught,
it's not Hokum. Okay. It's something
Yeah,
else.
Don't do that. Don't do that. Has taught at Loyola Marymount University and Calvin University. Senior fellow at Trinity Forum. Latest book is called How to Inhabit Time, Understanding the Past, Facing the Future, Living Faithfully Now. Editor-in-Chief of Image Journal. Written 25 books, which, John, I know, you had said earlier.
Well, I was just saying between the three of us, we got 25 books.
Yeah, that, which is great. I mean, we should be really proud of that.
I feel proud of that.
Yeah, we
yeah.
should. That's
well
something
done.
To celebrate.
Well done. Look yeah. at
Thank
us.
You.
Look
Thank
at us.
Hey,
and it feels
there's
like
no
with
I
such
in
little
team,
effort.
Jamie.
There is.
That's true. That's
but there
true.
Is a me. Okay, writing has appeared in newspapers such as the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, USA Today, as well as in magazines such as America, The Christian Century, Christianity Today, and the Los Angeles Review of Books and Lit Hub. So a very, very learned scholarly man, and we are thrilled. And just for a fun fact, just to end it all out, preach your first sermon at 19.
Oh, where did you find that?
Listen, we have our producer. He is just scouring the internet.
Yes, that is true.
What is it like to be a preaching prodigy? How did that feel?
Well, the irony is I only became a Christian a year before that. So I went through a kind of cataclysmic conversion experience and then was sort of spit into the pulpit, so to speak.
Yeah, how did that go?
I don't remember a thing about that. Oh, no, that's actually not true. That's actually not true. It was Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 to 3. God at various times in sundry ways has spoken through the prophets. But now in these last days, he has spoken in Son. That is, Christ is the word. That's the language God speaks now. Anyway. Yeah,
Look
it was a Christmas
you.
Sermon. It was a Christmas sermon, as I recall.
Jeez, the
so,
big
yeah,
one. That's a
it
big
turns out I remember this more than I thought. But this is a tiny little country church.
Yeah,
this is not like some mega. This is the tiny little country church. So that's a feels like a lifetime ago.
I love that you didn't know it, and then your eyes rolled back, and you just started reciting it.
That's a sign of age.
Touché.
So as we ask everyone after we read the brag sheet, what is you, as Dave is reading the brag sheet, what's happening in your brain? Are you just like, let's just tune this out and get past it? Or are you like, yeah, I've done all that stuff?
Honestly, I was thinking that you didn't list the things that are most important to me.
Mm.
Which
wow.
are
let's go.
That I have been married for 34 years and have four
wow.
children, and three
Congrats.
Of them are married, and they all still seem to love us. And I'm not saying that to, like, I just had a conversation with somebody recently, which is, like, you could basically burn up all the other stuff, and at the end of the day, kind of, it's also why I think people don't know me if they don't know that about me. And that's
yeah,
really
well
sort
said.
Of what sort of centers my life. And I come from kind of a really, really messed up, broken family background. So the 34 years in the adventure of marriage is to me the most That's the thing. I would brag about it, except that I think it is only by the grace of God and my wife that that's still
right. I mean, and with the kids, I mean, I have two girls who are 11 and 8.
Oh yeah.
And I'm like, thick of it. If I could just know, if I could somehow know that in, you know, however many years in the future, they're going to be out there in the world and they're going to be doing great and they're going to be, you know, that would give me so much more peace than any kind of like, hey, you're going to win a Grammy in 5 years or whatever.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. We just said, I have no idea if this is what you want to talk about, but I'll just say, this past Christmas, all the kids were home and Deanna and I were saying, we were just kind of watching them be with one another. And they didn't need us to want to be with one another and to be friends. And I would say the most remarkable joy that a parent can find, maybe I'm still waiting for grandkids and I'm pretty eager, but to this point I would say the most remarkable joy I found as a parent is seeing how much my kids love one another and how much they are friends. And we were fortunate in that our kids lived they're all 2 years apart, and actually they overlapped a lot in like college and their friends circle and stuff. So they have really forged their whole friend networks are overlapping and shared. Mm-hmm. And so we feel like we just have this whole tribe that we know and that rumble in and out of our home. And to see them loving one another is a great
job. I mean, cut to literally this morning that my three children in the car.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I'm having to tell them. I literally said this out loud. We're not getting out of car for school until each of you tell another something you like about them. And they all went, this is dumb. I don't want to do that. And I thought, I failed. I have a podcast called Dadville, and I am failing so miserably at this task. I got home and just lamented to my wife. I was like, our kids, I love them. God bless them. They're one. But what are we doing wrong? And she's like, yes. I don't know.
She's like, we? Like, I'm sorry.
No, but that's every one of us, right? Yeah, yeah. Don't. These are
Children. Hang on.
I remember when our kids were little like that, and then you'd be at church, and you'd see this other family, and they've got these, like, gorgeous, wonderful, you know, Nobel Peace Prize winning children.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're like, wow, I guess that's never going to happen for us. And then they're like, oh. No, when they were 11, they were a nightmare. Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
And so you're like, oh, I take some encouragement.
Okay, yeah.
You got to remember that.
I mean, can you trace any, like, do you have any wisdom around anything you can look at and go, man, I do think this moment or how we thought about this thing as we raised them helped get us to this moment where they're enjoying each other and we can sort of sit back, you know, and see the whole thing unfold?
Yeah, it's a good question. I do. There's a couple things. One is we lived abroad at a couple of different points.
Oh, wow.
In England, both times, once in Cambridge and once in York. And I think that those were when our kids were little, like, you know, elementary school, middle school kind of ages.
Do they call York Old York, by the way?
There is a section of York that they call Old York, and it's is that a thing? Do I not know?
Well, I'm just saying, you know, if there's a New York, York I would York. Imagine yeah, that's yeah, the yeah, old yeah, one. Yeah, yeah, you know, that's like York, the OG no, York.
It has a walls around it. But I would say that experience of being pitched into another culture and then basically being thrown upon one another as the sort of hub of how you would survive this experience. It could have backfired, but I think in our case, it really solidified the kids' care for one another and a sense of friendship in that regard.
Yeah.
I think the other thing we did is we really grew up with our kids. Like I was 19 when we got married and 21 when we had our first
child. Oh, my goodness gracious.
So we got an early start.
You're like, I've already got a sermon under my belt. Let's just get it going.
Right. That's right. And so I think that we grew up with them and we're pretty, like, unpolished and vulnerable and admitted when we made mistakes. Just created, I think, a certain solidarity with one another. Yep. That's not to say that, you know, I don't owe them apologies for all kinds of things, but there was it just created a certain openness and transparency with one another, which I think they have for one another, too.
It's so interesting you just said that, Jamie. I think about this so much as a parent. How I think what I want or what I feel like I interpreted as a parent was going to be this real sense of like,
I am together. You are the child. You are untogether. There's a distance, but it's a healthy distance. And the more and more that we've parented, because we really do believe in what you're saying, this vulnerability, apologizing, sort of living as appropriate in front of the kids, it's much more that. It is much more sort of like they have a front row view to kind of like, wow, this is a little bit of a you-know-what show, but they love us and they're trying their best. And it's funny because I'm like, man, I hope this is right, because this is not my thing was going to be like, you know, you kind of have your place and I have my place and I love you. But there's a, you know, and it's just not how we're living. It's much more the opposite. And Annie and I laugh a lot. We're like, man, I hope this is right, because if it's not, this thing is going to be a dumpster fire. But well, it's encouraging to hear you say that.
It is an act of faith. I mean, it's, you're entrusting yourself to, you know, a kind of ultimate father who is out-parenting all of us. Oh, and yet you have this sort of covenant stewardship of these creatures for this time. And I think honesty is so much more powerful than the veneer and illusion.
That's such a good word.
The kind of like perfection stuff. I think I teach college students, and college is often a place where kids are working out often that kind of scenario where they themselves weren't given permission to be messy, because there was this kind of story that was being performed that didn't help anybody, it turned out.
Yeah.
Do you feel like, knowing what you know and of studying what you studied, do you think that is something that is iterated differently through the ages? Meaning like, you know, boomer parents that sort of parent a certain way, and then their kids come out and then they parent a certain way, and then me and my generation sort of is that, because I feel like when I talk, like my parents, who were great parents and still are, but it was very much like you read this book and this is kind of what all the parents read, and there was sort of this like, this is where we are, this is where the kids are, and not never the twain shall meet, but there was just, the gap is closed, and I feel like keeps closing, you know, to where now I get nervous and I'm like, oh gosh, are we doing too much of that other thing where it's like, I need to sort of have a little more posture over here. I mean, do you find that that's changed? Is it always just a reaction of the generation before?
I mean, that's, I'm just speaking as a rank amateur, like any of us, and I'm not a sociologist, so I won't claim any expertise, but that does ring true to my experience and what I get to observe watching, you know, 25 years of young people come through college. As you see these waves of, I guess I'm Gen X or something. And I would say our boomer parents maybe did not bequeath the best habits of vulnerability and availability and, you know, that kind of stuff. But I also, I kind of share your sense that, I do think there's another way to fall off the wagon on the other side, which is to err on the side of just such an identification that now you're not even a guide, or you're not even a sage, or you're not even the friend who's further down the road. And I do think that seems like a live problem, or a live risk, at least, in certain generations
for sure.
of parenting. And in that sense, it's interesting to see how kids will sometimes respond very positively to adults who are not their parents, who come with a certain kind of, almost like a certain accountability structure. You know what I mean? It's like, I have high expectations for you because I think a lot of you and I care for you, and to express that. Christian Smith is a sociologist at the University of Notre Dame who's done a ton of work on youth spirituality and religion. And he says one of the most significant indicators of children sort of continuing in the faith is whether or not they have adults in their lives who are not family, who are invested in them in that kind of way of like serious love that's expressed as accountability. And you can basically just track, if with that variable, you can track the ongoingness of somebody's journey in the faith, which I think
that is so
useful. I mean,
it says
a lot about what we try to do in churches, right? I mean,
that's
the beauty of, you know.
That's exactly right.
Community.
Scouts or whatever is this kind of connecting with kids who aren't your parents aren't your children. And it's a great gift.
So anyway, Judas said he and Pontius Pilate, double P as I call him on the basketball court, weren't going to buy a copy of the Teen Study Bible because they felt like it made them seem like quote unquote bad guys.
I see. I mean, what did they expect, right? Yeah. Why couldn't they just not read those particular parts of the Teen Study Bible? I mean, they could still learn a lot from the other parts,
right? I know. I can't imagine someone not wanting a copy of the TSB.
Look,
call the Teen Study Bible.
I can't either, Dave. The Teen Study Bible, it's a classic.
It even comes in updated editions now available in the NIV
King James and NKJ, which is the New King James, mm-hmm. and it sold over 4 million copies.
That's crazy.
John.
You know, the Teen Study Bible is great because it helps teens discover how God's truths relate to their lives today, and it helps them apply God's word to issues that they face, like bullying, depression, peer pressure, stress, etc.
Yeah. You'll also find notes, articles, book intros, and character profiles, Q&As, and more, offering the knowledge, strength, and clarity to navigate life's challenges with Scripture as your guide.
Find out more about the Teen Study Bible and order your copy today at amazon.com/teenstudybible.
Dave. John, we all love summer, and our kids especially love summer, but we lose that consistent schedule of when kids are in school, and that can create some summer childcare problems.
You know what? Thankfully, though, Dave, there's a solution.
What?
Windy. That's W-Y-N-D-Y. Listen, it's an app that connects families to college student nannies literally in minutes. These nannies are background checked, interviewed, and honestly, just awesome, Dave.
That's right, John. And Windy has been around for 7 years and has been used by over 20,000 families. There are hundreds of qualified college student nannies on Windy near you, working full or part-time.
All you have to do is go to windy.com/dadville to start searching for a nanny. And as a special offer, they're going to knock off $50 off your search if you go through that link. Windy provides top-notch service, but at a fraction of the cost of traditional nanny agencies and no ongoing fees.
Okay, so here's how it works. Go to windy.com/dadville to start your search. A Windy concierge will find great matches for your job and set up interviews for you. You can choose the one you like.
Get started now, because there are a lot of parents out there looking for nannies for the summer.
That's right.
Go to wyndy.com/dadville.
I just had a conversation with my dad recently, and I forget why we landed here, but we were talking about my dad said the difference between my generation, my dad speaking, and your generation is we wanted to raise adults who could function in the world. That was the goal.
Seems like a good goal.
That seems totally
seems like a good
great.
Goal.
Yeah. And he's like, your generation, you want to really know your kids. And there's nothing wrong with either one of them, but it's like to our...
Both good goals.
Both good goals. But yeah, it's got to probably be some kind of a balance. And I definitely think he's right in that I go to bed many, many nights just feeling like I didn't connect with my kids. I didn't have that moment. And there are times, I think it's easy... It's best seen through our spouses. Like, I can see what my wife Amy is going through, and she can look at me and be like, babe, you're obsessed with finding the time to just connect with them. You don't have to play with them every time they want to play with you, you know?
Right. So. Exactly. And sometimes putting that, the burden of that expectation, like, I need this connection moment.
Yeah.
Is, you know, what does C.S. Lewis say? Like, the happiness is the thing that you don't get if you chase it. It's more like a byproduct of chasing other goods.
Right.
And I think it's I can already tell that you're a father who is alongside your children. And then the opportunities for that kind of knowingness, I think, bubble up from sometimes when you're shoulder to shoulder instead of face to face.
Right.
Like you're sort of involved in something, you're invested in something, you have a common collaboration in something, and that's where actually real solidarity starts before, and then you get to be known. But I do think this dynamic of being known, I mean, it does speak to, if that's true, that does ring true to me, by the way, what your dad said. That dynamic of being known is such a deep human hunger that the gospel speaks to as well. Do you know what I mean? Like that God would see you and know you. It's that kind of Psalm 139 intimacy of like being known in the very core of your being and being seen and being recognized and named. And I do think we don't want to lose that, because anonymity that characterizes our society, despite the fact that we see everybody all the time. Do you know what I mean? Like we live in a society of just constant mutual display where you have to be constantly showing up the branded self for everybody that's around you. And yet in a way we've never been lonelier.
Yeah,
because we actually don't see one another. We just see our performances of whatever it is that we think is expected of us. And I think home should be the safe space where kids can drop all of that self-consciousness and be seen and be known. And I'll also tell you, one of the great joys that you have to look forward to is being known by your kids. Without question, aside from my wife, my kids know me more deeply and more intimately than anybody else, which is also slightly scary. But
for sure,
that is a really, really incredible experience. It's like, oh, you know what? Turns out we gave birth to our best friends, you know, like it's this incredible opportunity, which I just don't ever want to take for granted.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's beautiful.
Okay. Nice. We got to get this interview going here because I will say, I mean, we have so much stuff to talk about here. I'm going to kick us off because Dave Barnes here is the man who introduced you to me.
Okay.
Jamie. And he has been talking about a particular book, I mean, for I don't know how long. It is On the Road with St. Augustine is one of Dave's favorite books.
I thought you were going to say a different book, actually.
Yeah. And so I'm about halfway through that book, and I'm also about halfway through your newest book. And so Dave has 25 questions for each of your books. So before we get to that, though... And also, actually, you just said something that reminded me of a bit in the new book, How to Inhabit Time, that blew my mind. It was, I wrote it down here, Sally Mann's memoir. Sally Mann was the professional photographer. And she was, I should have you talk about that a little bit. It was fascinating.
No, I'm guessing you mean the passage where she said she realized that she didn't have actual memories of her father because what she had were photographs.
Yeah.
And those photographs became a mediated substitute for she couldn't, right? Is this the part that you're thinking of?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the way in which sometimes in our penchant to try to preserve a memory or a moment, we actually create this distance between us and the intimate beloved one, because now all we remember are the pictures.
Right.
And I think that's a really, really interesting. What resonated with you about that?
Well, it was the fact that she felt this sort of distance from her father because she had so many photographs of him. And then she talked about like a dear friend of hers who was a fellow artist that she had no photographs of. And she had she could recall, you know, every detail of his face. And that also with the story of Tiger Woods' two wins, the 97 and the 2019, there's like a side-by-side photograph that you talk about where in 97, he's surrounded by a bajillion people and they're all in this moment together. And then in 2019... he's surrounded by a bajillion people and everyone has their iPhone up capturing this moment. And if it's true what's happening with our memories, it's like we're losing the lives that we're leading, you know, in a really scary way.
Exactly. Even though we think, we're preserving everything because we're getting a freeze frame capture of it. In a way, by being fixated on that mediated experience, we are letting the memory slip away because we're not forging it as a memory that you then kind of carry in your heart and soul and bones and under your skin, and the kind of memory that you can recall after that person is gone. I think that it's something that has made me just try to be present to moments rather than preserving the moments.
Yeah, yeah.
And in some ways, by being present to the moment, it will live in me in a richer way than the photo in my pocket, which is one of 60,000 others that when am I ever going to find it again?
I'm glad that was fruitful for you.
It's really interesting. When you wrote this book and put this latest book out, How to Inhabit Time, it feels like, to that point, it's entering in a world that is like, I'm wondering if you were conscious of this when you were writing. It's like the posture that is almost, I don't know if required is the right word, but the reader needs to get them, they needs to slow themselves down. I mean, the book is broken up into meditations, and it's, and you say up front, you're like, this is not, if you're coming here to learn something, this is the wrong posture. You're coming here to like be or to dwell, I think you said. Were you conscious of like, all right, this book I think is needed now more than ever, but it's maybe more, its acceptance is more challenging now than ever. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, you're repeating my publisher's worries, which is, this book kind of asks a lot of people. That does not sound like a recipe for selling a lot. But I agree. I do. Yes. You've discerned rightly that I actually think we need a little more friction in our experiences of things to get us to sort of pause and dwell and be. And I think what we like are experiences of things that you can just kind of keep scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. That slides by, that's slippery, that's easy, that's digestible. And we can, I honestly sort of generate a lot of Christian content in exactly that sort of way. I'm not sure that deepens our capacity to be available to the deeper work that God wants to do in us and the attention that's required to kind of jackhammer into our own souls and see what it is that we need to work through. So, yeah, the book kind of asks a lot of people. To me, that is a way of respecting a reader. Do you know what I mean? I think readers are smart. I think they are hungry. And I think that they want to actually be stretched and pulled beyond what is easy. And that reader I love, and I say, come on a journey with me. If somebody is looking for 7 Habits of the Highly Successful Memorizer, there's lots of books out there for you. Yeah. They're not my book.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Good news, lots of books. Bad news, wrong author.
Though he does have lots of books, ironically. Yeah. As John said, I mean, Jamie, this book, I have it right here. This we went through, I don't know if you know this book, it's written by you.
Yeah.
It's called On the Road with St. Augustine. It is, I can't tell you how much I love this book.
That's
literally
so encouraging to me.
I bought
I really
probably 5 to 10 of these and just gave them to people. Like, I just had them in my car. I love this book.
Thank
and
you.
And my men's group went through it, and we loved it, like every single one of us loved it.
That's awesome. Thank you so much.
And so what you were just speaking in what I was going to say, one, so everybody listening, obviously all of these books are great. This one I just know particularly more than the others. But one of the things you just spoke to time, I was going to say that there are so many things in this book. It became a joke. Like, I have so much of this highlighted that I was like, there's no way we're going to be able to talk about these things. But one of the things you do talk about is sort of like how to live in this space and time we're in. And I tell you something that I struggle, this is in one of your earlier chapters, but this feeling of not being at homeness, which, you know, how do I, again, you do this in your new book, how do we think about space and time? Something I realized about myself a few years ago was I have this very real innate struggle with trying to make heaven here. And some of that's really great, and it's like, okay. Mm-hmm. But I really think if I try hard enough, I can really be, I'm just trying to make my life comfortable and like heaven here. And it was so profound to me that I think the quote is a sense of not at homeness, making myself at home. And you said how to create a refugee spirituality, which to me is so good because it is like that thing in me that's like, why isn't this working? Like, why can't I just make this heaven now?
Yes.
Because I really believed this for a long time. I was like, no, that's what we're supposed to do, is like bring heaven down to earth. And I think reading your book, it was so helpful to me because it was like, no, it is this idea. Can you talk about that? Like refugee spirituality.
Yes. Yeah. No, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. I think that's part of what I have learned from Augustine is, in a way, to be
someone who is longing for God's coming kingdom will mean I always feel slightly ill at ease.
in the now.
Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that's not a that's a productive unsettling. That's a that's a productive uncanniness, right? Of not being at home, because it's a reminder that we still pray thy kingdom come. And every time we do that, we're reminded it's not here. And otherwise what happens is, I think, as you say, not that this is what you were trying to accomplish, but we can get, we can settle for baptizing whatever the present order and experience is and say, oh, that'll work. That's good enough. This is, that's sort of, you know, here's heaven arrived. And in that way, we give up the deeper fullness and flourishing and glory that God really is calling us towards. So it, it's why, you know, there is a certain kind of impatience that is salutary. There's a certain kind of impatience that should be, that characterizes the people who sing Maranatha, come Lord Jesus. You know, like it's like, how long, O Lord, is also a song we sing. And I would venture to say that maybe too many Christians are just trying to be comfortable here. And then what happens is, it's not only you get a very sort of funky, sort of settled form of Christianity, but it ends up to then just kind of like baptizing the regnant order. And I think we get a lot of messiness. I think that there's a letter that Augustine writes to this like Christian Roman official. So he's a Christian, but he has like a high order position in the North African government of Rome, of the empire. And you can tell that this Roman general is getting kind of impatient. It's like, okay, can we just like make the kingdom come? Like, I know exactly what God wants and I'm going to make this happen. And Augustine writes to him and says, we should not want to live ahead of time with only the saints and righteous. We should not want to live ahead of time with only the saints and righteous. And I think, is that, does that speak to a little bit of what you mean? Is gosh, like we have this certain kind of inclination to live ahead of time, and it's like, can we hurry this up? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? And we therefore we want to say, oh, let's just camp out here. Whereas I think God wants us to live this sort of refugee spirituality. It is, it's a pilgrimage. We are on the way. Some days we're going to experience that almost like it's exile.
Yeah.
But that's because we're made for a home that is coming. That's we have tastes of it. We have foretastes of it. We want to be ambassadors of it to the world that we're in. But we actually want to sort of live with a kind of holy impatience about that.
What's Dave?
Hey, Dave.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I got to tell you, if I can be vulnerable with
you. Yeah, please, please.
I am craving some electrolytes right now, but I don't know what to do. Can you give me any guidance?
John, you have come to the right place.
Okay.
It's called Element, but it's spelled in one of those cool ways that makes the 40-somethings like me and you, mainly me, feel young and hip when we figure out how to say it correctly.
Okay. Element. Is that right?
No, no, no. It's the letters L-M-N-T, and it's pronounced Element.
Element. Oh, okay. See, yeah, you're right. I feel cooler already.
You got to say it sort of like this. Element.
Element.
Replenishes my electrolytes with a tasty drink mix with everything you need and nothing you don't. That means lots of salt with no sugar. It contains a science-backed electrolyte ratio of sodium, potassium, and magnesium with none of the junk. No sugar, no coloring, no artificial ingredients, no gluten, and no fillers.
Mm, electrolytes, they're what I crave, Dave.
Yep.
You know, and you don't have to be a brawny professional athlete like myself to benefit from Element. Electrolytes facilitate hundreds of functions in the body. Don't get me started because I'll name them all from memory, but just I'll just keep riffing here. The conduction of nerve impulses, okay, right? Hormonal regulation, nutrient absorption, fluid balance. Yeah, stop me.
I don't know if you're going to forget fluid balance. My favorite flavor of Element is watermelon salt. Watermelon salt. John, I think you'll love mango chili.
Whoa. I don't know. That's a little spicy meatball right there.
Spicy meatball.
But I can't wait to try it.
Right now, Element is offering a free sample pack with any purchase. The Element sample pack includes one packet of every flavor.
This is the perfect offer for anyone interested in trying all of our flavors or who wants to introduce a friend to Element.
Yeah.
Get yours at drinklmnt.com/dadville. This deal is only available through the Dadville link. Mm. And Element offers no questions asked refunds.
That's drinklmnt.com/dadville. Try it totally risk-free. If you don't like it, share it with a salty friend, probably a pirate, and they will give your money back, no questions. You have nothing to lose.
Do it.
Element. Oh my gosh. I didn't know you could stretch that far. That's amazing.
I can't. That's actually a friend of mine.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Speaking of your friends, do you ever bring your kids to the grocery store?
Oh, Dave, that's like the rookiest of rookie mistakes. Oh. No. In fact, you shouldn't even bring yourself to the grocery store.
Whoa.
It's Thrive Market all the way, Dave.
That was a trick question, and that is also the right answer, John. Thrive Market is our go-to for all our grocery and household essentials, and the convenience of ordering everything on their website or app and getting everything delivered to your doorstep quickly is a huge stress reliever.
Huge stress reliever. And the products are amazing. Mm-hmm. Plus, you can curate your own shopping experience with a few clicks and trust that you're getting high-quality products so that you can shop worry-free.
Yes.
I don't like to shop worried. You know what I mean?
Worry shopping is the worst.
You just place an order for some gluten-free items, like using the gluten-free filter.
Ooh.
Boom. It just gives you all the gluten-free stuff.
Wow.
I got FitJoy grain-free pretzels.
Yeah.
PIP corn white cheddar cheese balls.
Guys, for those of us in the loop, it's called pipcorn.
No. I call it PIP. It's, a Midwestern regional thing.
Totally.
And I got some Lotus ramen noodles.
You are off. You're just off.
I'm off to the races,
you are
Dave.
Crazy, John. Not only do I save time shopping as a Thrive Market member, I also save money on every single grocery order. Over 30% each time on average.
That's crazy.
They even have a price match guarantee and a deals page that changes weekly.
That's right, Dave. In fact, on my last order, not to be competitive about it, but my last order of gluten-free items, the cost was $46. I saved $11.
I saved 10 last time. Plus, when you join Thrive Market, you can enjoy it and join it, John. I was trying to make both those
words.
It's
not an either or.
It's choose your own adventure, okay? And when you join and enjoy Thrive Market, you're also helping a family in need with their one-for-one membership matching program. You join, they give.
Save time and money and shop Thrive Market today. Go to thrivemarket.com/dadville for 30% off your first order plus free $60 gift.
That's thrivemarket.com/dadville. thrivemarket.com/dadville and join today.
Well, one of the things that I think is so fascinating is I've lived an extremely charmed life, which is wonderful in so many ways, and it's really tricky with this because if I'm not careful, any sense of dissonance to me is not right. I go, no, your parents should be, they should love you, and your friend should love you, and your wife should love you, everything should work, like, because it felt like for a while my life that sort of did. It was like to no accolades of my own, but just for whatever reason, that's the way God saw my life to be for a while. So what
do you mean
dissonance?
It would feel ungrateful for you?
Well,
to
it
not
just
recognize
felt like
that, or
it just felt like this isn't how this is supposed to be. So I got to make this right.
Yeah,
and I think once I realized, like, oh, dissonance is just here. Like there is a great void. That's never. It was really off-putting to me and frustrating.
Mm.
And then I think you put it so well and it made me understand. Like, oh no, this is native to what we do here. You know, so if we can realize that, there's beautiful ways to occupy and to realize why we feel this way and do our inner work and how that iterates into our friendships and marriages and kids and everything. But I think it is funny because, one of the weird things that happened from having a family that was pretty, normal growing up is it's sort of, and that's one of the things that I think it's funny, even circling back to our beginning of this conversation, is there is a weird thing I want my kids to understand that feels not logical to me, which is, no, the world is hard and it's going to beat you up, and you need to be ready for feeling like a vagabond. Because yeah. I don't think I felt that way. I think I felt yes. like, no, the world is mine. And it's great. And you put your hand to it and it works. And it's all these things. But, you know, getting to this age was like, this isn't working anymore. And I think with my kids, I'm like, man, I will be doing them a great service if I help them understand that younger than I did. Because I had a real crisis of like, why is this stuff just not working like it used to? Whereas yeah. opposed to people who grew up in different situations, they knew that immediately. I mean, some of my best friends sure. were like, oh, they had awful childhoods, and they're like, oh, this is, I knew that day, you know, yes. 100 of my life, yes, you know, where, yes, yes, you know, yes. And so I think there's something, and you know, it's too, I love, continue that thought, like how you call the church community a refugee camp on the run. And so it's funny, because if you think about refugee spirituality, then where is the community of the refugee? And I think it's, and I just thought that was such a beautiful idea. And it speaks again to the importance of the church, right? Like how, yes. I loved your thoughts on that and how, so can you explain that too, like what you mean by refugee camp on the run?
So in the sense that it's a reminder that there's kind of no Lone Ranger Christianity, right? There's no, this is not an individualist endeavor. And so to be in Christ is to be in Christ's body, which means that this is an inherently communal and social calling, right? So I'm embedded in a people. God is in the business of actually calling a people.
Yeah.
But that people has to be careful to sort of like live lightly in the world and not get too comfortable sort of settling down. We are a pilgrim people. We're a refugee people because we are looking for a country to come. I would say this is one of the places where I think probably, you know, we've experienced forms of Christianity where that temptation to imagine, oh yeah, we've settled, we've arrived, we've, you know, the kingdom yeah. is here. You know, the Black church has never had that illusion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's yep. very, very yeah. important. Like this is a place yeah. where we would do very, very well to just listen to now the experience of Black Christians for whom that song of mm-hmm. exile, that mm-hmm. song of How Long, O Lord, that song of like, we are a pilgrim people on the way, and you don't have any illusion that we've arrived. That's that's a discipline that we do well for the whole church to learn from in that respect. Yeah. And I think it is something I love about Augustine is his picture of being a Christian has none of this kind of rugged individualist illusion about it. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Like you cannot be a Christian on your own.
Mm.
And it's funny when they basically cajoled Augustine into being a bishop, which he did not want to do. He said, I will only do it if you actually allow me to keep living in the monastic community that I've been a part of, because I can't imagine how I could do this if I'm not living amongst these brothers who are, you know, my accountability, my friends, my community. And I think that's a really, especially given sort of American temptations to individualism, I think that's a really powerful antidote.
Yeah. Well, and I think you just said that, John has heard me say this a million times on his podcast, but I don't know if there's anything that I've learned more in the last probably 5 years of my walk with the Lord is that it is a body, and like he is always pushing us. Yes. And, you know, you have moments of solitude, but like he's always pushing us toward each other. And I think one of the great griefs that I see in our generation is that there's just such a exile. It's like there's just so much, I got to go out and do my thing, or I find God in the woods, and that's why I don't go to church. And, you know, all that is its own thing, and I get it. But I just think we miss so much of the what God's intention, honestly, is for us to be polished and, you know, like you got to have friction. You said this so well earlier, but the friction thing is just so true.
It should not be avoided.
Yes, yeah. So much of what we have to gain is from the friction of it all.
I think, you know, on that sort of like the isolation and exile and people think they can pull it off on their own, there is also a version of that feeds into unhealthy notions of what it is to be a family. So I think sometimes we buy into a mythology that the family is now this autonomous, independent unit, and your household is its own little kind of fiefdom or kingdom, as if you could be, you cannot raise your children on your own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what the church says. Do you know what I mean? Like the church says, this, it is this sort of village approach. In my tradition, this I don't know what Christian tradition you guys are coming from, but so I'm in the Reformed, Dutch Reformed tradition. We baptize babies. Don't write me off. But one of the most beautiful parts of that liturgy is the parents present the child to God and say, we are making these promises to raise them in your gospel. But then the entire congregation stands up and makes promises to that same child because we have a sense of the insufficiency of these two to pull off the gargantuan endeavor of raising children. Yeah. And that's where the body then becomes very, very concretely invested in all of our children together. And I think that runs counter to a lot of sort of mythology in American culture in some ways.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. It's the other side of this, which you speak to so beautifully in this book. Again, I can't recommend this book enough, but I don't know if you've read it, Jamie. It's really great. But is this idea of loneliness. And I think like two of the things that just, it's two of my favorite moments of book, but you know, Marina Keegan, who you talk about, the opposite of loneliness, when the check is paid and you stay at the table, just like what that, that quote ruined me. I was like, who doesn't want that feeling? And I think the other one, you know, which is Augustine, is whenever you go out, walk together, when you reach your destination, stay there. But just this idea that, like, I think, you know, another thing that I think has just been so prevalent to me in my last few years of this journey, too, is just how lonely I am. But just not native to me. And I think, and you know, my best friend in the world was the one to tell me that. Like, we had gone on this walk, and I was just doing the thing where I do, where I'm just talking. And we got to, and we sat on the front porch, and he just said, if I was you, I think I would be really lonely. It just sounds like you're, and I just was like, no, I have a million friends. I'm not lonely. But all of a sudden, I was like, oh my gosh. And much like I said with this earlier realization of sort of like, I'm trying to make this thing my home, I realized I was fighting so hard to not be still enough to be lonely. Just entertain myself, find something to do, you know, talk to my friends, talk to my wife, play with my kids, just like don't be still enough. And I think what you talk about so in this book is this idea that like, this is how this is, you know, this is and it's so funny because we go from community church, but realizing that even in community church, we're still these lonely people that are navigating life together, but hopefully in community. I thought those two quotes, I mean, that check is paid. It ruined me. I was like, feels like heaven to me, right? Like that you don't get done, then it's like high fives and they go home. It's like, well, what else you got to talk about? Do you know what I mean? Like that idea is so powerful, you know?
Yeah.
And you hope you do find it in a church, in a community where those people do that for and with you, you know?
Right, right. No, thank you for sharing that. I thank you for being vulnerable about your own struggles. I think you're not alone. I think maybe still is the case that men are susceptible to this in unique ways because of sort of expectations about the sort of what the facades that we are supposed to wear or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I see a real hunger amongst men of my generation to sort of be kind of like, what are we doing here? Like, what are we pretending? And how can we be more intentional about sort of leaning into one another's lives? It's a challenge though, because on the one hand, I think solitude is a good thing.
Yes, 1,000%.
The ability to live into solitude,
right,
is deepens my sense of being beloved. You know, Henry Nouwen has this amazing line where he says, "Being beloved is the core truth of our existence." And I'm trying to live as if that's true. Being beloved is the core truth of my existence. And I think we run away from that truth so many ways. We think, oh, we're only loved if we prove it and so on. If we find the solitude and can dwell in the solitude to actually come to that deep awareness that we are beloved, then I actually think we can risk the vulnerability to be open and porous selves who then can let other people into true intimacy so that then we overcome that loneliness.
Yeah.
But it takes practice. It takes time. It takes, you know, all we have to unlearn a lot of habits to be able to do that.
Gosh, well said. Especially the self-preservation habits.
Totally.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Totally. It's like, I'm going to do everything.
Totally. Not to mention just like all the expectations of efficiency and productivity and all the things you have to accomplish. And you want to be, you know, a provider for your family. And there's all of these things. And it's like, how can we hold all of these things together
Well, it's just so much more acceptable for men to be those kind of lone wolf. And, you know, like cycles beget cycles. It's like if that's what you kind of saw, like your dad just kind of worked and then he came home and he was with the family and you never, every now and then you might see him with a friend or whatever. I'm not saying that was my situation, but that tends to, then you're going to grow up and you're going to be like, well, that's kind of the North Star that I'm aiming toward. And then it just begets more and more and more.
Right. And you absorb that and on registers and that you're not even aware of. And so you end up replicating it. I wish I was in my home office. There's an amazing poem. I can't even think of the author right now, where this guy, let's say a guy our age or not your age, is watching his father and he sees his father at the golf club and he can talk to everybody. He can talk to anybody. He's just like Mr. Garrulous, Mr. You know, conversationalist. And he's never had a conversation like that with his dad in his life. And and at the end, he's like, I wonder if I wasn't his son, if my dad would have had a conversation with me.
Jeez,
and it's like, wow. I mean, it's, but you can imagine exactly how that would go, right? Like we are somebody with everybody but our children. And I just keep trying to like deconstruct that and say, I can't be that. Like they should get the same me as everybody else gets. But isn't it weird?
Well, and you can understand it because you're like in that scenario, in that poem, you're like, well, yeah, that dad has too much to lose now. It's a like years long web of mistakes and but with you know, Joe at the club or whatever, who cares, you know, there's less at stake there.
There's less at stake. That's right.
It's funny. Right. I was telling a friend, the same guy, we're talking about this stuff yesterday. The thing that is crazy to me, my oldest is 12. And is he mine? And it's so funny because where, you know, Annie and I, if we've done anything right, we have apologized to our children. And that sounds like a brag until you realize we're apologizing, which in
I get it.
But like, and I realize as he's getting older, it is harder for me to do this. Like it used to be and it was this beautiful moment of connection. Mm-hmm. It is getting harder for me. And I'm watching myself going, what is going on? But it's exactly what you said, John. It's that there's more at stake here. Like he's getting older, so his respect and those things are growing with him. And I can feel that. And so now I'm like, well, there wasn't as much to lose before. And now it's like, man, he could really look at me and be like, hey, you know, that's kind of a jerk move. And I'm like, dad, come on, it is a jerk. You know, like it just, it carries more weight. And so it's funny. Yeah. I just didn't see this coming. So I was like, oh, it's going to be great to always apologize. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, man, as a dad who's walking on the golf club, I'm like, there's a part of me that goes, yes, I get that. Because it's like, this is your kid. He's the one that looks at you and goes, this is my dad. And you're like, I could really swing and miss here. Totally. And then the one person in life that really looks at me that way, I've lost it with them. You know, it's like it's crazy.
I think one of the great mysteries that I'm still quite awed by is how forgiving children are.
Oh, man.
Jesus. You know what I mean? Like how easily that comes to them because they want
so
the relationship
badly
restored. Mm-hmm. They want communion. They know when it's been broken.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things we always said in our house was when somebody apologizes, you don't say it's okay.
Mm.
You say, I forgive you.
Yeah.
Because that actually names it for what it is. If you say it's okay, it's like, well, nothing happened.
Yeah, that negates it happened.
Something's been ruptured here. Something I let you down. I broke a covenant. I lost your trust.
Mm.
And when I apologize, if you forgive me, that is grace and mercy and a picture of God's love. And they're the suppleness of the child's heart to be able to do that. And then to watch how that slowly petrifies in us is that's the most.
Isn't it? You know what's crazy though? It is crazy to me. I mean, like, of all of God's chemistry experiments, the part of all of us with our parents fascinates me as much as anything does. That you can be as mad. And I really believe this. Now, there's some extreme cases that this may not apply to, but I'm not even sure it doesn't then. But if you have a truly heartbroken, vulnerable, repentant parent, like genuine, like if you put a lie detector test on them, and they sit with that child and they go, I want you to hear how sorry I am. I think just about any child is going to at least feel like, gosh, this feels good. And I want to maybe start building this back if you really mean that. I remember telling one of my best friends years ago, my dad and I were working through all this stuff, and it was a season of kind of like me growing up and sort of my first little like, you know. Mm-hmm. And I remember like in a moment of vulnerability, just telling him, being like, he drives me crazy. And there's times where I wish I did never have talked to him. And he looked at me and said, that's not true. And I was like, whoa. And he was like, that's not how this works. You may feel what you feel now because you're mad, but you do not mean that. And I remember that really shook me because he was right. And I remember thinking, like, even that moment, it's probably the maddest I'd ever been at my dad. I was like, yeah, I really don't. Because the minute my dad calls me and goes, like, what are you doing? How you doing, bud? I'm like, tell me about you. I'm like, oh, my God, I had the best show last night. And then we ate some pizza. And I'm like, isn't it funny how it takes so little to conjure that thing of having a parent that really is interested in you and is sincerely. It's like you can't. It's so hard to deny because it is so hardwired in us. You know, it's like one of those things. I'm like, God, you were genius to do this because you can't fight it.
Well, it does feel easy to me now. My girls are still pretty young, but I have always wondered, like, for that connection and that easy forgiveness and that easy apology. I wonder over these last years and more as they're getting older. I'm like, I hope if I keep doing it, that when they're 24, it will be like second nature to do it. What was your experience like with your kids? Now that
I would say don't get too worried if there's phases where it feels like it's more pulling teeth and there's a little more reticence. And I think, you know, I'm of a sort of theory of developmental stages where kids have to differentiate themselves for their parents, and that's going to look like all kinds of things. And that might look like reticence and resistance to doing that kind of thing. And I get it. I generally just always want to encourage younger parents that parenting is a very long game.
Wow.
And, you know, your relationship with your child is never defined by the season that you're in right now. Right.
Wow.
It's an unfolding story.
Jeez.
And so I would say that, and that was a gift that was given to us by older parents, you know, parents who were like kind of a generation ahead of us. And they would tell you, look, here's what's coming in How to Inhabit Time. I say, you know, you can't transcend time. You can't time travel. But the closest you can get to cheating is have friends who are older than you.
Yeah,
and in a way, they can report from the future back. And I would say once I worry a lot that the church subtly teaches parents to confuse moral conformity to virtue formation. Right. I don't think kids knowing how to play the game of rule following is the same as them actually acquiring virtue.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think becoming the kind of people for who that they own their own, you know, moral and ethical and spiritual obligations requires them to actually know what's at stake and create some distance and test the boundaries a little bit. So I'm always grateful for communities where nobody freaks out when a kid is like doing it wrong or, you know, going off the I just think. God keeps covenants, and this is a long game. So to your question, that's a long way of saying, don't get too worried if you find that there's a season later where it feels like it doesn't come as easy. That doesn't mean that the disposition isn't still there. They're just also working on something else at the same time, and it's still a foundation that's going to come back. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, that's good to hear because I'm already in that phase with one of my girls. It has begun.
No, it's very, I mean, and I do think that's something that happens earlier for girls. And I think it's something that keeps happening early and earlier in our culture because of all sorts of cultural dynamics and forces that force kids to grow up much faster than they should.
Sort of like the parental weight too, which I think, John, is funny that we talked about, but like, it's not just the kids that, if I'm not careful, I'll think, like, why are they rebelling? Why are they doing these things? But I can very much underassume the weight I have in their life. Like, I can not measure my words well. I can overreact because I'm not remembering a integral thing, which is what we just talked about. Like, I will forever occupy a very specific space in this child's life. And if I'm not careful and remember that, to exactly your point, Jamie, about, like, you know, this is a season. This is not, you know what I mean? Remember the truth that overlays this whole thing. And two of these quotes, I mean, these are amazing. One, when the family once went to a crowded restaurant on a Sunday, this blows my mind still, and we had to wait for our table. My father took me outside. You quoted this. I can't remember what this is from, but you may produce a tennis ball, put a penny on the sidewalk, and proceeded to play a game with me. Hit the penny with the tennis ball. In retrospect, nothing could have been more trivial, and yet the fact that I had been included, that my father had casually asked me to share his boredom with him, nearly crushed me with happiness. Mm. I mean, what a incredible...
Isn't that amazing? Quote. Yes, yes. I think that's David Foster Wallace, but don't quote me now. I'm a little nervous.
It's so good.
It's really, really great. I love that notion of being included in boredom.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I thought that was.
That is such a,
but
like,
just,
what a remarkable
again, that
thing.
The dad sees you and goes, join me. And then the second one, and it's not only sons who go looking, the search is human. Margot Maine, for example, invented the term father hunger to help diagnose the cause of eating disorders and in daughters, young women, for whom they had experience of father absence deflected their father hunger into unhealthy relationships toward hunger and food. Mm-hmm. This kills me. Who of us isn't an heir to the dreams of our fathers? I mean, holy cow. You talk about the weight of being a dad. Yeah. And it is crazy to think about that, you know? Like, and I think, again, I can misremember that in moments because I'm like, this kid doesn't respect, he's whatever. And it's like, oh, bro, we may never know that other than to think of our dads, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the irony, of course, is, as you know from the book, I do not have a father. My father left when I was 11. Mm. And then my stepfather left, you know, 10 years later or whatever. And so I feel like I've been parenting without a net, except for all the fathers God has gifted me with in the friendships in that body of Christ. Like, I don't know how I could possibly have known what the heck I'm supposed to do if God hadn't put men in my life who fathers to me, but also showed me what fathers do. And instead of, maybe there were times where I was kind of jealous, but I, for the most part, all I do is think of with gratitude that, you know, in a way God can multiply fathers. Like, he can make, the stones cry out. He can turn stones into bread, and he can sort of like raise up fathers for us everywhere. And I don't have a father like that. And it's still that pain of father hunger, I don't think will ever go away. This past Christmas, one of my teachers, actually, at the Institute for Christian Studies that you mentioned in Toronto, this is, you know, 25 years ago, is a dad figure to me. And I got this email on Christmas morning, and he just said, "Hey, Jamie, I was thinking of you. I love you. You're doing great." And it's like, oh my gosh, this is everything. Sorry. But it's kind of like everything I would have wished to ever hear from my father. But I don't need to hear it from him now because he gave me Jim, you know, and he, I know that that was God saying, well done.
Yeah.
Keep it up. And that to me is just the miracle of the economy of God's grace is things don't have to come always from where you expect them. And no story is over. You know, like the absence in my story is not the end of the story. And in the same way that even our failure as young fathers is never the end of the story. You know, like, I was not a very healthy young man when I was in my 20s because of I hadn't really sort of grappled with all of this. I hadn't reckoned with it in the words of How to Inhabit Time. And not until later did that happen for me. And then I was like, okay, I owe my kids some explanations. And in all of their generosity, you know, they forgive and they journey and they, you know, we have just the most beautiful relationship in spite of all of that. So I love it that God is a God of resurrection and unending stories of surprise.
Yeah.
Okay, so I mean, I would love to talk for 7 more hours.
Well, I was going to say, thing. Dave, I feel for you because I'm looking at our shared note right now.
Oh, yeah, there's.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I feel like I've been rambling.
No, this is, this just means we have to have you back. Yeah. So the last thing I wanted to kind of get your thoughts on, you talk a lot about this, you know, sort of this secular age. And one of the things I just sort of in parting, I wanted to ask with our children growing up and, you know, me and John, especially in a lot of our listeners, the 6 million people that listen is give or take. I mean, we're not, it's a little fuzzy on the numbers, but like, you know, growing up, especially in 2024, what are your thoughts about really two things? One, having kids in this time, because I know, you know, it's a little different than the seasons before. And then, so one, just having kids now. And then two, what are kids are having to think about that maybe we never had to, or is truly native to this time, this secular age?
Yeah. Great questions. I mean, I'm going to start with the second one, which is my experience is most intimately of like 20-year-olds, right? As a college professor. Yeah. And so you could not pay me to be 20 years old today.
Man,
it
brother.
Is
Wild West.
Nightmare in terms of, and honestly, I feel like we are the ones who gave them this world. My generation made a lot of the systems and structures that they inhabit. Mm. I think they experience paralyzing self-consciousness.
Mm. Wow.
It just amplified. I mean, you knew what it was like to be 14 in a high school and you're walking up the bleachers at the football game and you imagine that everybody's looking on you when they're not.
Right.
But now there is never a moment in your life in a social media world where you're not actually expecting that you have to perform for everybody. And I think that is such a
terrifying,
debilitating, paralyzing reality that whatever we can do to help kids escape that and be safe from that. And I think that probably looks like us being much more countercultural about technology than we have been. As the church.
Yes.
Do you see, just a side note.
I don't want to just pick on technology, but I just think it's one of the factors.
Sure. Sorry, I mean, with Dave and I, with our kids being a little younger, like, I mean, that is like forefront of my mind as a big fear. Do you see that being a professor of college kids? Is there any kind of, I'm like so rooting for a backlash against technology and the whole thing. Are you seeing any signs of that at all?
I'm seeing some of, there is a certain, I think, exhaustion and apathy that is setting in, and a certain, I'm not sure if it's like a concerted resistance, but to me, it's more like an exhaustion and apathy, which if somebody gave them an opportunity to live into different rhythms, they would take it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like if the students were coming on a retreat and we said, you have to leave your phones at the door, I think 2/3 of them would say,
thank God.
Heavens.
Yeah.
Like,
wow.
Take it. The rest have like real kind of addiction stuff going on, which is also its own sort of heartbreaking.
Yes,
I remain, I'm not an optimist, but I am a hoper. And I remain hopeful about those kinds of possibilities. I just think we have to go through the difficulty to get to the hope. As far as parenting, I mean, in some ways, I almost don't want to presume to say, because we, you know, we have friends who are younger than us with little kids and we watch the things that they have to think through, you know, are just like another world for us. And I would just say, as much as we can parent in villages rather than independently,
will
help us. Yep. Do you know what I mean? Like look for channeling your kids into friendships where you know you can co-parent with their friends' parents is a gift, but not always possible, I realize. I think a sense of solidarity amongst parents goes a long way to saying,
that's great.
Might not have all the answers, but we have this sort of intention.
There's a higher chance with more of us.
Yeah. A wisdom and multitude of counsel.
Yeah. You know, I just kind of recently like learned, I think it was maybe Jefferson Bethke that we had on, and we, in our conversation, we were talking about how recently the nuclear family home has... Yes. Like with Sears, what were those things called? Like they would send you a home, and how that that
manufactured homes kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
And how like that was
and the suburban. This is a very recent,
it's
relative
so recent.
Model.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It's a very modern, culturally, you know, contextual. The and also pretty often predictable along racial lines, which is this is what white people do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Whereas the extended family home is much more common in minority communities.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, there's I think about this a lot, actually, when I think of my daughter and son-in-law who live on the other side of town when they have kids. And we're like, we've got this kind of, you know, house with empty bedrooms. I'm like, I feel like we could do this.
Are we doing this right?
Do you know what I mean? But then I think my daughter would be like, I'm not living with my mom that close to us. Just like, you can come visit.
But it is funny how it's totally, you know, being born when we were born. We're like, okay, well, this is just the way the world is.
Yeah.
And then we ironically, whenever, you know, our kids, we have some help from outside help, we throw out that phrase like, it takes a village, in some sort of like twisted irony where it's like, no, it actually does take a village.
Yes.
But exactly. We just have this crazy setup right now. All right.
And it's one of the things I think that makes, you know, I think one of the bad moves the church made, you know, probably 30 years ago is we started to stratify the church by age. We segmented so that we actually do not experience worship in common. We don't experience formation in common. I am a huge advocate of the messy loudness of the multi-generational sanctuary.
Yeah.
Mm. And because I think that's the prime incubator for understanding that we are the family of God. We are the people of God together. And sometimes our sort of specialized stratification of segmented Christian experiences by age, I think we cause some of the problems here, and that rather than solving them.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Man, that's a fascinating thought.
Well, as we start our second hour here, I wish that were the case.
If only I didn't have faculty center.
Right.
No.
Okay, so we want to end this with a little lightning round here. So these are some rapid fire questions.
I suck at these, by the way.
No, you're going to kill this.
No, don't tell yourself that. You're great at this.
All right.
All right. If you could have the world read just one of your books, which one would it be?
Probably On the Road to St. Augustine, honestly.
What a book.
Yeah.
What?
And what a quick answer. See, look at you.
Even if it's just pandering to
me,
which I'm fine with.
It's the book that's existentially closest to me.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's probably most of my heart is in that book.
But this is what people, I have to plug this really quickly. This is what people got to understand. This is how I sold everybody. It's so well written. It's not just great thoughts. Like it's beautifully poetic. It's so good. It's so good.
Thank you so much.
So, okay, second, what is your favorite book? Just book in general. Can't say the Bible.
I will say Augustine's Confessions.
Oh, wow. Well,
that's kind of cheating a little bit.
No, it's
not a big fan of favorite questions because I think there are many reasons to love different kinds of things.
Right.
If I was on a desert island,
yeah, okay, that's the book. Okay,
I would take Confessions.
Okay.
It's lightning round, and I lost my place. Hang on, I'm holding it up. Okay, if you could have a meal with your favorite people, no, I'm just kidding. If you could have a meal with three people, dead or alive, but they would be alive at the meal, or they could all be dead at the meal, if you would prefer. Who would they be?
This is going to be weird. I don't even know if your listeners would care, but I would say I would like to have Georg Hegel, who's a German philosopher from the early
1800s.
Okay.
Probably Augustine and an American writer named James Baldwin. Is that a name?
Yeah. Baldwin.
I just think fascinating characters. And I think the three of them in a room would be very, very fire. Yes,
yeah.
Lots of fire.
Yeah.
Yes,
that's exactly. So good. Okay, finally, if you wrote, and maybe you will, I would love to read this if you do, but if you wrote a book on fatherhood, what would it be called?
That is a great question. If I wrote a book on fatherhood, it would be called I'm Sorry.
That's great. That's so good. Oh, I love
it's
that.
It's not
so
okay,
much.
But I forgive you.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Jamie, thank you so much for your
this
time.
This was really great.
I was so excited, and I so enjoyed chatting with you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.